I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to start today by mentioning that, as you would imagine, NPR is continuing to follow developments concerning that deadly tornado that struck Oklahoma yesterday. We hope you will stay tuned to your public radio station or check our website, npr.org, for the latest updates. Now, though, we are going to turn to the debate about balancing safety and civil liberties in New York City. On Monday, closing arguments were heard in a federal court challenge to the New York City Police Department's stop and frisk policy. For years, civil rights groups have accuse the department of racial profiling and point to data that 87% of the stops last year were of Black and Hispanic people. But city officials, including New York City's mayor Michael Bloomberg, continue to defend stop and frisk.
I can't imagine any rational person saying that the techniques are not working and that we should stop them.
We wanted to talk more about the whole question of racial profiling in this case and more broadly. So we're joined now by two law professors who've been following this issue for decades. David Harris is professor of law and a distinguished faculty scholar at the University of Pittsburgh. Professor Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Michelle.
Thank you. And Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law and Police Science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Professor Jones Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For people who have not been following these events in New York City, why is it that this policy in New York City has come under such intense scrutiny from so many people for so many years?
Well, there are two primary issues. One is that 87% of those stops involve Black and Latino persons, and almost 90% of those stops are people who are innocent as opposed to who are found to be involved in criminality. There is the suggestion that the stops are for the purpose of finding guns. However, in 98.8% of all cases, no guns are found.
Professor Harris, if you'd pick up the thread there.
Sure. It is legal for police officers to do this as long as there is reasonable suspicion. But it became a tactic that looks like it was over-relied on to the point that people felt this was not a tactic being done for them to provide greater public safety, but being done to them. And the people subjected to this in an outsized way were overwhelmingly people of color.
Professor Jones Brown, I mean, the plaintiffs in the case presented a secret recording of a police leader who told officers explicitly that Black males 14 to 21 were the right people to stop. What's the city's response to this specific kind of evidence that says that these particular people were targeted because of their race?
The city seems to support the notion. You may know that the commissioner was on Nightline the other evening suggesting that Blacks are being understopped under this policy because 75% of violent crime perpetrators are described as African-American males, while only 56% of folks who are stopped are Black. So Black and Latino males between the ages of 14 and 21 or 14 and 24 are believed by the commissioner to be the crime problem in the city. No differentiation is being made between those who are law-abiding and those who are not. In addition to the recording that you spoke of, Senator Eric Adams testified that the commissioner said to him in front of then-Governor Patterson that, yes, stop and frisk focuses on Black and Latino males because they want to instill fear in those males. And when the commissioner was questioned about whether he thought that was, you know, fair or valid, he said, how else are we going to get guns off the street?
That's actually what I was going to ask you, that if you're just joining us, we're talking about a case involving New York City's stop and frisk policy. That case is being challenged in federal court, and closing arguments were heard on Monday. We're talking about this with law professors Dolores Jones Brown and David Harris, who've been following the issue closely through the years. But Professor Harris, I mean, again, what's the answer to the argument that if that is indeed the group of people where crime is most present, then that's the appropriate group of people to subject to this level of scrutiny? What's the answer to that?
The answer to that is that targeting them based on their racial or ethnic appearance is not a successful crime-fighting strategy, despite what the commissioner and the mayor seem to believe. What they say is, see, it's working. By this method, they say, of instilling fear in people, we don't want people to carry their guns. That's why we do this. So they win either way. Targeting people based on race or ethnicity has never been shown, not in New York, not in anywhere else where this has been statistically tracked, to be the successful way to get guns, to get drugs, to get bad guys. Because what you do is you force people overall to pay an enormous cost across an entire racial or ethnic group for the actions of a very few people. And it also leaves out the fact that you could certainly use other methods, as other cities do, to force crime down that don't rely on this kind of very aggressive stop-and-frisk activity that embarrasses and humiliates and, most importantly, drives people away from police. It gives them the idea that the police are their enemy. So what they are doing is they are simply saying, it works because we know it works. Look at the results, and of course, heads I win, tails you lose.
Professor Dolores Jones Brown, you're in New York. Why do you believe that the city officials are so vigorously defending this policy?
I think part of it is the investment in the stereotype, that if the commissioner actually believes that the crime problem in the city and the mayor believes that the crime party in the city are Black and Latino folks, then they can't move off of that belief. The other notion is they believe that if they were to change tactics now, in 2012, we now have data that stops were reduced by 22% and crime did not go up. We also have data from the first quarter of 2013 where stops are down again and crime has not gone up. And so it's a really good question that you ask. Given this information, why isn't the mayor or the police commissioner changing positions some to at least recognize we can reduce the number of stops without jeopardizing the public safety?
Professor Harris, you have any final thought here?
It just points out the fact that they can do the same kind of crime reduction with a much lesser degree of this very intensive stop and frisk activity. Stop and frisk is legal. It's done in every city as long as there is reasonable suspicion. There's no reason that police can't do it. What we don't want to have is this kind of over-reliance on one tactic that takes an incredible chunk out of the cooperation and the partnership that you need to have between police and the people they serve.
Professor Jones Brown, before we let you go, mm-hmm. Both of you are critics of the policy. Both of you clearly believe that the policy has kind of passed the point of being constructive, to the point where it's destructive to the social fabric. Apart from the city officials who are defending it, what do people think about it in the city overall?
People are confused. There are members of the communities of color who have accepted the notion that this is what they need to be safe in their community. And I think it's a sad position because those folks don't accept the fact that they have as much a right to be able to walk to the store to get that quart of milk without getting stopped as if they lived in a different community. And so that's problematic. So communities are divided over whether they support or they oppose stop and frisk. There are other policing tactics, something called hot spots policing, that's being used by the NYPD that doesn't necessarily involve stop and frisk, that researchers have found have in fact contributed to the crime reduction in the city. So one of my suggestions recently has been to do more of that and less of stop and frisk, because we can see a direct causal relationship between that kind of a practice, hotspots policing or something else, where we focus on the few dangerous people that can be identified individually and remove those people from the street while leaving the law-abiding people alone.
I just think a lot of people listening to our conversation will not understand what is wrong with what the police are doing. I mean, the police, I think pretty much anywhere in the country, I think most people would agree, if they see something suspicious, mm-hmm. then I think most people would believe that the police should stop and intervene in whatever is going on. So what is it that, in your view, the mm-hmm. New York City Police Department is doing wrong?
In my view, the department is engaging in something I call appearance profiling. And so if they see a young Black or Latino male in certain types of clothing, like a hoodie or sagging pants, and they appear to be seen between certain ages, they automatically suspect them of criminality. But there's nothing criminal about being young, being Black, being Latino, being male, and wearing saggy pants or a hooded sweatshirt, or wearing particular colors that the police assume are gang-related. And so it is the way in which people are not allowed to walk on the street without being suspected simply because of how they appear. It's not even their behavior, because the majority of stomps are based on something called furtive movement. It's a very ambiguous term that New Jersey has almost outlawed as a reason for a reasonable suspicion or a reasonable stop. But it is more than 50% of the time cited as a reason why a police officer, in combination with other factors, has stopped a person on the street in the city of New York. And so the notion is that you should not be suspicious simply based on what you look like, simply for where you're standing or walking. The notion of high crime area is often cited. But people live in an area because that's where they can afford to live. And so everyone who lives in a high crime area should not automatically be suspected of being criminal. And in fact, the crime statistics in the city indicate that not everyone, and in fact, a very small number of folks who live in high crime or low crime areas, are involved in serious violent offending. And the rhetoric around stop and frisk doesn't make that point clear.
Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law and Police Science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. She was with us from our bureau in New York. David Harris is professor of law and a distinguished faculty scholar at the University of Pittsburgh. He joined us from member station WESA in Pittsburgh. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Needless to say, there are other perspectives about stop and frisk. Tomorrow, we expect to hear from Paul Brown, the deputy commissioner of the NYPD. We'd also like to hear from you. We'd like to hear if you have an experience with stop and frisk, either as a person who's been stopped, as a bystander, or as a law enforcement officer. Send us a tweet using hashtag TMMFrisk. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you've probably heard that the stock market is seeing record highs, but there's also a new poll that shows that fewer Americans are participating. We'll try to find out why in just a few minutes. But first, we want to tell you about a major data breach affecting thousands of participants of a major government program. The program is called Lifeline. It reimburses phone companies for providing service to low-income Americans. A new investigation found detailed personal information from one of those private companies available online. That includes the Social Security numbers, birth dates, home addresses, even copies of nutrition assistance and welfare cards of more than 100,000 applicants. Isaac Wolf is a national reporter for Scripps Howard News Service. He led the investigation, and he's with us now to tell us more. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us just a little bit about the Lifeline program, if you would. How did it start? Who is it for?
Sure. The Lifeline program actually dates back to 1985 during the Reagan administration. And it was created to make sure that phone service was accessible to the poor, the needy. It's continued for just about 30 years, and it was expanded in 2005 to include cell phone service. And this has created a lot of problems. There have been a lot of concerns toward waste, fraud, and abuse. You've heard stories over the past few years of people getting multiple phones, of phone carriers enrolling folks who maybe were dead or didn't live at those addresses, because, of course, the phone companies are making money per individual that they have signed up for the service.
So how did you get into this investigation? I mean, were you looking for something else, or had you gotten a tip or something that this kind of personal information was available online?
No, nothing of the sort. A couple other reporters and I at Scripps were just looking into this program, you know, just looking at what was going on. There's been many new rules that have come down the pike, and we just wanted to see what was going on there. And over the course of doing some internet searches earlier this spring, we stumbled across about 170,000 personal records that were posted online, and those involve two companies that are participating carriers within this program. It's Terracom Incorporated and its affiliate, Yourtel America.
And just for people who might not understand why this is a problem, why is this a problem that people's Social Security numbers and birth dates and addresses and all of that stuff was so readily available?
Well, your Social Security number is really the most important sensitive piece of information about yourself that can be used by identity thieves to open accounts in your name, to pass themselves off as you. Social Security numbers, we know, also are used by people who aren't you to get jobs.
So it's basically an open door to identity theft. So as far as you know, how did this happen?
You know, Terracom, the parent company behind this, has not given us a straight answer. We are still trying to understand what led these records to be posted publicly online.
Now, we reached out to Terracom and its affiliate, Yourtel America, which are the companies that you say were responsible for the breach. You said they wouldn't give you an interview. They didn't give us an interview either, but they did issue a statement. And Terracom says that the company deeply regrets, in quotes, that this information was accessed. It says it has implemented security measures and notified federal and state regulators. It says that that information has now been taken offline. But they also say that you did not just use simple internet searches. In their statement, they quote that a digital forensics investigation by Terracom has revealed that the news service used sophisticated computer techniques and non-public information to view and download the personal information of applicants. And your response to that?
My response to that is everything that we did and everything that we looked at was publicly accessible. We stumbled across these records through a Google search. We've posted online video of how we access these records, and we have also written about how we access these records. We've asked the company to sit down with us. We've told them that we would show them exactly how we access these records, and they have refused for nearly a month our sit-down interview requests. And frankly, I would just say, you know, if their story really does hold up, which it doesn't, then why aren't they here answering questions? They're not.
We're talking with Isaac Wolf of Scripps Howard News Service. We're talking about his reporting. He and his team found thousands of applications with detailed personal information posted online for participants in a government program to provide phone service for low-income Americans. You also talked to some of the participants in the program, people whose data was accessed. What did they say about this? Did they have any idea?
No, they didn't have any idea. They were shocked. You know, I spoke with one woman, Linda Mendez, in San Antonio. She works the night shift cleaning a gym, and she uses her Lifeline cell phone, her Terracom cell phone, to call, check in on her husband and four kids, make sure that they've done their homework, that they're ready for bed. She also uses her phone to coordinate appointments for her kids, including one of her daughters who has Down syndrome. And this is a stumbling block for her. I would just also add that prior to the Terracom information release, her family has experienced identity theft. Her husband has had his Social Security number misused by others over the past several years. So this is something that people really get. And I would just also add that this program, these applications, are for folks who are among the most vulnerable. They are the poorest. They oftentimes have disabilities. And so you or I, you know, it might be an inconvenience for us to have to spend the dozens of hours calling credit reporting agencies and banks. But we're talking about folks who are working the overnight shift, or, you know, maybe they just don't have the wherewithal to fight this. And they're the ones who've been exposed here.
Did your reporting indicate any hypothesis of how this could have happened?
I can't speculate on behalf of Terracom. And I would just also add that the records were being held by a third-party contractor, an Indian company called Call Centers India. We've reached out to them for comment. They also have not responded. But I would just say your question is a fantastic one. It's the top of the list of things that we're waiting to hear back from. There's a couple other questions that we really think that Linda Mendez and others need answers to. I would say the second question that others need answers to is, why did Terracom have these records in the first place? As we report, the Federal Communications Commission actually forbids Terracom and other companies from keeping copies of food stamp cards, of driver's license, of pieces of proof that these applicants are eligible. Well, the vast majority of the records that we found were precisely these types of scans, iPhone camera shots, so on and so forth. Why'd they have them? It's not clear.
So basically, they're allowed to have certain information in order to be sure that the applicant is qualified. But once the applicant has been qualified, they're not supposed to keep this stuff.
Well, according to the regulations, the companies are not supposed to retain these records. Exactly what that means is unclear. We've reached out to the FCC for an explanation. They haven't given us one. But what we can say is that many of these pieces of evidence date back to last year. So whether or not these folks were approved or still in some sort of limbo or they'd been rejected, they have records that appear to go back well into last year. You know, these types of photocopies, these scans of people's Social Security cards, driver's licenses, food stamp cards, And it's not really clear why they had them in the first place.
Final question. Is there any broader lesson here that you think we all need to take note of?
Well, our reporting doesn't only look at these release of personal records from Terracom. We actually look at some other privacy issues associated with the Lifeline program, including a database that's being built out through the FCC. And it's going to include personal information from social welfare programs across the country, from many different social welfare programs. There's concerns there about privacy issues.
Isaac Wolf is a national reporter for Scripps Howard News Service. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Isaac Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. It's been my pleasure.
To read Isaac Wolf's full story and then the full statement from Terracom, just visit our website. Go to npr.org/tellmemore. We're going to switch gears now and take another look at the stock market. Last week, about the same time, we talked about how the Dow has been hitting record highs. But did you know that stock ownership in this country is at record lows? According to a recent Gallup poll, only about half of Americans, 52%, now own stocks. That's the lowest level since Gallup started tracking that number back in 1998. We wondered what, if anything, that means, so we've called once again upon one of our money coaches, Robin Farzad. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's with us now. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. How are you?
Good. Well, just to recap, we're seeing almost daily records on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I know that there's some dispute about whether that number really means anything, but what do you think that means?
I think across the board, you're seeing markets in the United States hit highs, and it's not just the Dow. I think it illustrates writ large that the money is awash in the system. The Federal Reserve has this gigantic fire hose, and it's splashing money onto the plane, and inevitably, it's going to make its way down to corporate balance sheets, and especially when people can't really get an opportunity in their savings. Institutional investors have yields that are so low. They're going to chase return in the stock market, obviously.
Now, a lot of people think, and in fact, our guest last week said, that even if you aren't in the market, this is good news for the average American. Do you agree?
It's good news psychologically. You get that ping on the nightly news. The Dow ends at another high today, the S&P, the NASDAQ at a 12.5-year high. But it's not very comforting if you're not exposed to that. If you say, well, what if I didn't liquidate my 401k 3-4 years ago? What if I didn't take that hardship withdrawal? I'd actually feel the wealth that I get a brokerage statement now that shows that the balances are higher. It's a regretful incident when, in fact, you did have to sell out. And right now, you realize that if you didn't, if you could have gotten funds somewhere else, you would be partaking in this rally financially.
Well, that was going to be my next question, which is, why is it that the percentage of Americans who own stocks is at this point? Now, I should, you know, mention that since 1998, that's not a huge long period of time, but the high was of stock ownership in this country was 65% before the financial crisis hit. Now to 52%, that is a real number of people who are no longer in the market. So is it your view that that's mainly because of people who cashed out because they needed emergency funds and that's where they found their emergency funds?
I think they also got spooked in the market that was down 40%. You had a flash crash after that. It was very easy to say, gosh, the world is falling apart. The last thing I can depend on is this whimsical stock market. I'm getting out. In addition to that, I could be foreclosed on. I could potentially lose my job. If I didn't lose my job, why am I not tapping this asset, be it in my brokerage account or my company-sponsored 401k? And we saw that. We saw that in spades. We saw hardship withdrawals. We saw companies reporting that this was being done at a record clip. And very few people could have imagined that in less than 5 years, the market would have round-tripped back and been at an all-time high right now.
What would you have to say about why this matters? I mean, why do you think this is important for the country to think about? I mean, because, you know, the theory behind moving from defined benefit pensions to defined contribution plans, 401ks, 403bs, you know, things like that, is that people should have the right to decide, you know, how they use their money. If they feel that their money is better spent, say, paying off a mortgage or staying out of foreclosure, they should have the right to do that. What's your theory, or what would you have to say about why you think this matters, why it's important to talk about this?
Well, because we're on our own. As you describe yourself, these are self-directed plans now. The company is effectively handing you a series of pamphlets from a mutual fund company and says, go and decide on your own. And you're free to pull out the money when you want to do it. You're free to not contribute when you want to do it. And time and again, we see that the behavior is self-destructive. The investor thinks he's doing the right thing and getting out when the market is tanking. And right now you see more and more investors who had the money sidelined want to get back in when the market is hitting an all-time high. There's no, you know, I don't want it to sound too paternalistic. There's no one out there necessarily guiding hands. There's no great financial coach at companies that will go out there and hold every individual investor's hand. And this matters because increasingly you're on your own. Increasingly, we don't know about the solvency of Social Security. You're going to need the market to help you, especially after your savings and retirement accounts have taken such a wallop in this Great Recession.
Do you feel that this is also going to have an effect on equality or inequality of net worth? I mean, we often talk about sort of inequality of income, but the inequality of net worth of people, the kinds of assets that people have to live on later on. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that there could be a problem down the road when people who are middle income have pulled out money out of the market and then maybe 10 years from now don't have enough to live on in retirement?
I absolutely think that's a problem. And yes, the stock market still remains the province of the wealthy or the upper classes who have access to the type of jobs, for example, that can give you a 401k plan, that have the disposable income to put in separate brokerage accounts. And you've already seen such a widening of fortunes, a kind of a divergence of fortunes in this case. And it's only seen worse. I mean, the Gallup data showed how the 30 to 49 age group saw the biggest declines in equity ownership, and unemployment disproportionately hits this group. Foreclosures disproportionately hits this group. So there's a lot of catching up to do. And it's a quandary right now. Do you get back in when the market's at an all-time high? Do you even have money on the sidelines to get back in? There are no easy answers.
Another quote from the study: while soaring stock values may be an incentive to jump back into the market, continued high unemployment appears to be acting as a barrier. Without a job, some Americans may simply be unable to afford stock investments, while others may fear the market is still too risky as long as joblessness remains a national problem. End quote. Again, that's from the study. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think it still speaks to the fact that this is an optional thing for investors to get back in the market. When you look at it, though, over time, you're going to need something to help you accelerate, to help you catch up with the self-inflicted damage of the past 5 or 6 years. Not just self-inflicted again, Michelle. A lot of this came from out of left field. It's the worst economic calamity of our lifetimes. But again, you have to be able to have something, an asset class that can keep up with inflation, that can keep up with the cost of living, and do you something for retirement. And we've seen the market be that asset class historically.
And no more than a third of younger and lower income households are in the stock market. So final thought, Robin, younger Americans, do you think that there are implications for them?
Yeah, definitely. These are the years where it really matters, where you could really do yourself a big favor by being involved in the market. By if you're single, if you have a job, if you're in a position to garnish something from your wages and put it in a 401k plan, that is where it could really compound and do great things for you. And if you're not, you're losing out on your 20s. It's definitely a great age to be there, to be diversified. And unfortunately, these are the people who look back and when they are of means are going to say, wow, I missed out on that time. And I think this is where policymakers have to look more into financial education. You don't have people immediately out of college or people of that age necessarily thinking that this is when I need to buck up and have some sort of financial self-determination. It's left to your HR provider at work to kind of tell you something or two about it.
If that person still is there. Robin Farzad is a contributor to Bloomberg Business Week. He was with us from Richmond, Virginia. Robin, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. Take care.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, though, we are talking about a difficult decision that both mothers and daughters face, sometimes together. It's the question of whether to get genetic testing for breast cancer and what to do when you find out that you are at high risk. This issue was in the headlines last week after actress Angelina Jolie wrote a New York Times op-ed about her decision to undergo a double mastectomy. She made that decision after discovering that she carried the BRCA1 gene mutation. Her doctor said she was facing a staggering 87% risk of developing breast cancer. Angelina Jolie said she wanted to write about this to make other women aware of their choices. And now we are going to meet two women, a mother and daughter, who are also doing that after having faced this difficult dilemma themselves. Regina Brett is a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. She wrote about her and her daughter Gabrielle in an award-winning series called The Inheritance, and they are both with us now. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, thanks for having us on the show.
So, Regina, I'll start with you. When you heard that Angelina Jolie had written about this, when you saw her piece, what went through your mind? Did you think, yay, or did you think, oh, wow, now this brings up all this again? So.
Well, I found out about it when my daughter sent me a text, and I knew right then my daughter felt empowered that somebody else had kind of come out publicly. You know, when we had surgery, people kind of rolled their eyes and thought, geez, are you crazy? What are you making such a radical decision for? So I think it's important somebody that, you know, famous has the gene and is honest about her decision. So I felt good about it. There's also a bit of sadness about it that there are many women out there who are too afraid to find out or who just don't know their family history.
Gabrielle, what about you?
It's interesting. I sort of felt like she's part of our club now. Like, what a cool celebrity to welcome into the club. You know, one of the sexiest women alive, to go public with a decision like that sort of, I think, made us all feel like we had a little sexy back.
You know, Regina, you actually talked about this. You, in a piece that you wrote, you talked about the fact that, you know, you can be sexy and make this decision. But you had a very kind of extensive family history of cancer. You had breast cancer yourself in 1998. You found out that your cousins, two of your cousins were diagnosed. Their mother, your aunt, died of breast cancer. So for you, how did the option present itself of having this genetic testing and then, you know, the decisions that kind of flowed from that? Was that something that was always on the table, or was that something you found out later? How did that come about?
Well, you know, for years, cancer was prevalent in our family, but it was something we didn't talk about. Cancer used to be kind of that shameful secret in a family. My dad had 10 siblings, 10 in his family. Six had the gene, six died of cancer. So I was the first of the next generation to get cancer, and it was scary because in our family, if you got cancer, you died from it. We had no idea that we carried this gene. I had cancer, and then when I was recovering from it, two cousins got diagnosed, and then pretty soon other cousins got diagnosed, and we got the gene testing and said, oh my gosh, this is why we're all getting cancer. And the decision was still hard to make to have the double mastectomy because there's such a pressure in our culture to look beautiful, and the measure of your beauty too often is your breast size, you know, in Hollywood and models and all that. But you know what I learned from this so much was about how much I'm so much more a woman based on my heart, not on just my body parts.
How did the subject of Gabrielle getting tested come up? I mean, Regina, was it something you said, you know what, this has to happen, I've got to talk to her as soon as possible? How did it come up that Gabrielle should get tested? And then Regina, I'm asking you first, and then I'm going to ask Gabrielle her recollection of that conversation.
Well, first, my cousins got tested, and they were positive, and their mother had died of cancer. So I got tested, was positive. Gabrielle was 19 when I got cancer. She was away at college, and it was really difficult. We were so close. I was a single mom 18 years, so we're best friends, not just mom and daughter. And I was concerned about, like, should she know? Should she really find out this soon? But she's this powerful woman, and she thought, you know what? Information is power. And for her, it really did empower her. So I think it was the right decision to find out early.
Gabrielle, how do you recall that conversation or those conversations?
You know, I sort of felt that I just needed to know. I was going to, you know, go through life believing that I had a time bomb in me no matter what. So if I could get the relief of finding out I was negative and I was not a carrier, then I could relax a bit more. If I found out I was positive, then I felt like I could get the surveillance and the screening, regular mammograms, breast MRIs, and be really proactive about it. But not knowing was not going to be helpful because insurance wasn't going to cover screening unless I tested positive for the gene. So to me at 23, it was like it was a no-brainer.
And then, Gabrielle, you decided to have that preventive mastectomy at age 29. Talk a little bit, if you would, about that decision. And I hope I'm not being offensive when I say, I think, isn't it a little different, though, when you're, you know, when you're in your 40s and you've had your kids and then you're a young woman, you still want to wear that bikini, that two-piece.
The sundress, yes.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Sundress.
Oh, yeah, I can totally, yeah, absolutely. It's very different. You know, and my peers, I was, you know, I had to educate them on why I was making the decision. You know, a lot of people didn't really understand it. because most people, frankly, in their 20s aren't faced with any decision involving cancer. So for me, I found out I carried the gene at 23. I decided to do surveillance until I was 30. And surveillance meant MRIs and, you know, mammograms and things. Every time I got an MRI, I got an abnormal result, which was very scary. So for, you know, 3 months or 6 months, I would think, what if there's something there? And then they'd rescreen me and they'd say, oh, it's no longer there. But the reality was, you know, people around me were still being diagnosed. People I knew with the gene were still getting diagnosed. So at 29, I would say my husband and my mom decided for me that I should really consider a prophylactic mastectomy, a preventive mastectomy. And I sort of felt like, why now? Like, why can't I wait till I'm 30? And why can't I wait till I've breastfed my kids? And why can't I wait? But the reality was I was kind of in denial. And my husband sat me down and had a beautiful talk with me about how important it was that we not take any chances, because we were starting to talk about, you know, beginning a family and the reality of being pregnant and having extra estrogen in my body and, you know, the fear of what if something happened during that time. And he was really the one that sort of made the decision first. And then it took me a couple weeks, and then I came around to realizing it was the right thing. And so at age 29, before we had kids, I chose to get the preventive mastectomy.
What was the hardest part about that, Gabrielle, if you don't mind my asking?
It's interesting. The hardest part was just making the decision. And I can almost laugh about it now because, I mean, it's not that it's funny, but it's just that it's such a no-brainer now that we have a family and now that my priorities are different. The hardest part is actually coming to grips with, I'm going to remove a healthy part of my body. And I think once I made that decision, you know, the weeks leading up to surgery, I had a lot of anxiety. But honestly, the minute I got rolled out of surgery and I was awake and alert, I felt such relief, and that just that a weight had been lifted off of me. It's never been a decision I've ever regretted, you know, not for a day. And even now you hear about somebody getting diagnosed while they were pregnant or, you know, dying in their 30s. And it's that reality check of, oh, yeah, I did the right thing. You know, you can look back and it's a good reminder from time to time to know that it's not about how you look in a sundress. It's the reality that I'm going to be around for my three kids.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the difficult decision to have a preventative mastectomy with two women who've been there, Regina Brett and her daughter Gabrielle. The surgery's been getting attention after actress Angelina Jolie revealed she had it to lower her own risk of cancer. You know, Regina, you talked about some of this in a piece that you wrote. You wrote, Gabrielle wasn't ready to lose her breasts. She was afraid she wouldn't get to breastfeed her babies. I was afraid she wouldn't live to see them grow up. But I have to ask you, Regina, you know, Gabrielle just said she kind of feels like you and her husband kind of pushed her. You can certainly understand why.
We did.
But yeah. Did you feel in a way, I don't know, as a mom, obviously you're used to kind of thinking ahead, right? You can see the corners ahead that your kids may not be able to see. But it's such a personal and difficult decision. Did you ever worry you were pushing her in the wrong direction, that she would come to be mad at you afterwards?
You know, I felt that it was the right direction, because when I was getting radiation for breast cancer, there was a woman who was 28 who was also getting radiation. And I thought, that's the view I saw for my daughter down the road. And every year we would walk in the race for the cure. And I would walk in memory of my Aunt Veronica, my Aunt Francie, and my Aunt Maureen. And I'd think, gosh, I don't want to ever walk in memory of my daughter. And I couldn't imagine, and the grief of parents there who lost their children. And so one year I was at the race with Gabriel's husband. Gabriel couldn't make it that year. And I took him aside and I said, you guys can't wait. And I maybe that sounds terrible for a mother to do, but I just could see what was ahead, having been in that radiation room, seeing all those different women. And many of them were very young. And in our family, my aunt died young at 42 with six children, and the youngest was two. And it was such a reality. It was such a harsh reality to see that grief of a mother gone.
You both made the decision not to have reconstructive surgery. I mean, Angelina Jolie wrote in her piece that she did opt to have that surgery. I'm curious about, if you don't mind, again, and I thank you both so much for being willing to talk about this, because really everything I'm asking you is none of my business. But so thank you for sharing this. But why do you think both of you decided not to have the surgery? Regina, I'll ask you first.
Well, I had been through chemotherapy and radiation and surgery, and I felt like my body had just been through enough. And I also read a lot about reconstruction surgery. And for me, I wasn't going to have breasts again. I would have maybe an implant with skin over it. But for me, it wasn't the breasts that I had known and loved my whole life. I wouldn't feel anything. I wouldn't feel if somebody touched me. And I realized I would only be having breasts for everybody else to look at and say, wow, she looks great. So I opted to get, I call them my fake breasts. They told me you need to befriend your bosom buddy. So I bought prosthetic breasts and I named them Thelma and Louise so I could have a little fun with them and be lighthearted. And you know what? Every day I just slip them in a bra, put them on. And when it's too hot, I take my bra off and I go breastless. And I have two looks, kind of my gymnast look and my the way I always looked. And for me, I didn't want to get all new clothes, and it just still felt like I had a sense of my figure. So I'm completely fine having made my decision.
Gabrielle, what about you?
You know, it's interesting. I read an article in some journal of plastic surgery written by a patient, and she's talked about how doctors sort of push plastic surgery options on patients so that they can appear as though they fit in society, but that it actually is an elective surgery. And she made a really good point about the, you know, having additional surgeries increases your risk of complications, the risk of having multiple surgeries. And, you know, I just could really relate to that idea of why, if I'm making this choice to improve my health odds, why then would I put myself at risk? You know, going under anesthesia and having multiple surgeries and having discomfort and having increased recovery time, it just didn't make sense with the ultimate reason I was having the surgery. And the reality is, I too saw pictures and the women, you know, maybe it's improved over the last 6 years, but the women at that time that were having plastic surgery with the breast cancer gene, they remove all of the fatty tissue in your breasts. So it literally is skin over an implant. You know, it's not the Dr. 90210 look. And frankly, I've just never seen myself having implants. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's nothing I've ever regretted. And luckily, my husband was 100% supportive and behind me. So I've been really happy with it.
Before we let each of you go, I'd love to hear more about your decision to talk about this. I mean, you actually started talking about this before Angelina Jolie went public. And like her, you also wanted to help other women be less afraid. And I'm interested in what other wisdom you might want to impart there. So, Gabrielle, maybe I'll start with you, and then, Regina, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I think, you know, finding out that you have the gene, it is really scary. It causes a lot of anxiety and a lot of emotions. Deciding what to do with that information, you know, is equally as difficult. But I think ultimately, you know, once you can make a decision about it and make peace with it, it becomes not so big and not so scary and not so hard. And the reality is we all have different shapes and different bodies and different challenges. And I think that, you know, for women that are considering this kind of testing, one day it's really big and one day it's just not. One day other things are bigger and it becomes a lot smaller.
Regina, what about you? Any advice you want to pass on, since you might be the first person that anyone can hear who's talked about this?
Right. Well, I talked about it a lot because Gabriel was willing to share her story, which I thought was really powerful. I guess the most important thing is know your family history. When I was growing up, I knew my Aunt Francie, Veronica, and Maureen died of cancer, but nobody told us what kind of cancer because cancer was kind of whispered about. And a lot of us have those secrets in our families. Know your family history and examine your breasts. You know, that's how I found the lump in mine. You know, talk about it. It's just a body part that you can live without. And I think we need to kind of remember that life itself is the most important gift we have. And that's top priority all the time.
Any other advice for parents like yourself, Regina, who want to have these conversations with their own kids about this, but who might feel hesitant to push them into something that can feel very different? I was interested to hear from Gabrielle that people actually try to tell her that she was crazy, which I found interesting that people felt they could tell her that. But
well, people do. They think that you're, like Gabe said, that you're getting rid of some healthy part of you. But if you have the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, you don't have healthy breasts. You have a mutation in every single cell of that breast tissue. And your chance of getting breast cancer is so high, I don't think it's worth taking the risk. I personally didn't want to gamble my life just to save my breasts because I can live without breasts, you know. And your beauty truly comes from your heart, your soul. It's not about what you just see in the mirror. And I got to tell you, the two scars on my chest when I wake up and I see a blank canvas, it's like a big V where my breasts were. And I think of it as this is a victory. I get to live every single day. That's my reminder to get out there and live because life is short and I got a wake-up call. And that's my gift every day.
Well, good luck to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. We really
appreciate it. Thanks for having us on, Michelle.
Regina Brett is a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. She and her daughter, Gabrielle, joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. I thank you both again so much. And good luck to you both and everyone in your family.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.